The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition for this week. On this week's show, we're going to chat a little bit about a very esoteric-sounding topic, PTE 2020-02, to get real technical. That's a Department of Labor rule that has now started to affect those in the investment advising business. And it's causing a little turmoil in the industry. We thought we'd talk about it, what the ramifications are for those of you out there who are either practitioners or for those of you who are clients of the practitioners, and how it affects your decision-making on certain things and what you might be able to do, what ramifications there are to some of the things that have been done in the past pretty regularly. So I've got Jim on the line. He's joining us remotely from the deluxe studio in his personal residence. And he's got a surprise for us. He brought back a special present from Florida. Everybody knows from last week's show, he's back from his adventures in Florida. And what did you bring back, Jim?
Well, it's part of the reason Chris has made me stay home this week. It doesn't want me in the studio with him, spewing my breath as I talk. Yours truly caught COVID. So I made it 27 months before finally the little bugger got me. And it's been a learning experience. It's not, at least for me, nearly as bad as things I read. It's worse than a common cold. For me, it was much better than the flu and much, much better than COVID's been to some people. You heard some of those horror stories when it first came out. I think I'm getting better. I think for me, kind of the weirdest thing was at different parts during the day, I'd feel either horrendous or wicked good. And I would walk outside. I've got some acreage, so I'm not poisoning my neighborhood. I'd walk outside and putz around in the garden for a little bit. I wouldn't do much. And I felt actually good. And then literally, Chris, an hour or two later, I'm trying to crawl into bed because I felt like crap. It was just weird. And it continues to be weird.
Well, I hope I never get to experience what you're talking about so far. I've dodged the bullet,
I've
heard about a bunch of people getting it recently. So this new thing going around is crazy. So yeah, anyway.
The bizarre thing is Rachel was with me throughout our Florida stay. From everything I read, and I know there's physicians who listen to this, so if my information is wrong, please write me an email and rip me a new one and I'll correct it. But they said you generally will show first symptoms 3 days after being exposed. And my first symptoms were I woke up with a sore throat on Friday. Mm-hmm. I got back on Tuesday. That was the day I flew home. Friday is 3 days after Tuesday. And then it said you will generally test positive if you have it 5 days after being exposed. So I tested myself Friday as soon as I got the sore throat, negative. Tested myself Saturday, negative. Tested myself on Sunday, positive. So that kind of held true for me. And Rachel is showing no signs, although today as we record this is Tuesday, 1 week after being home. And she said she now has a headache and it hasn't gone away all day. So I don't know, either she has a headache for other reasons or she has COVID. That was one of my symptoms. I had a splitting headache with the sore throat. It was a painful headache. Anyways, just bizarre. It treats us all differently. I have continued to function, albeit not sharply. So
we're not letting him make any major decisions for the next few days.
they have not literally let me make any. We've got a couple of emails and they're like, nope, Jim has COVID. We'll talk about this later, which is good because I don't feel my brain is completely clear any stretch. But we'll see. I'm still trying to function as best I can at home, mostly because I'm the type of person, folks, who just can't sit around all day and do nothing. I can't. So I either have to be working or out in the garden or sick and sleeping in bed. And COVID, fortunately for me, has not kept me sleeping all the time or made me so sick that I can't function. So everybody be safe out there. It's a disease. It's real. Don't know to what degree. It's going to be here forever, I think. I don't want to turn this into a COVID discussion, but it's not going to go away. So we're just all going to have to get used to it. And honestly, Chris, I know you haven't gotten it. And I used to always say jokingly, but there was a shred of truth to it, that if I knew that I was going to be one of the people that COVID didn't hit hard and cause problems, I would like to catch it so I could start to build my own natural immunity, which I think is much better than this vaccine that, according to some people, may or may not even be working. Who knows? I don't anymore. There's both sides of that argument that I'm not going to get to. And I've taken my vaccine. And did that help? I don't know. But I always said, Chris, I wish I would get it if I knew it wasn't going to be that bad so I can start to build immunity. So in the back of my mind, I'm actually kind of happy I got it. From that standpoint, maybe it's going to help.
Wait till you get through it because it's not over yet.
Well, not that no, I but I would downer, assume if it was going to be bad, of course, I'm probably jinxing myself and I'll wake up tomorrow morning on death's door. But I would assume by now it's been 7 days since I've been exposed, according to my math. If it was going to get really bad, I would assume it would have done it by now, but I have no idea. Anyway, so that's it, folks. One thing we do want to say, there could be some uncontrollable coughing fits that Chris will try to edit out, but you might notice some edits in this week's show if things get bad.
If things sounds a little weird on some transitions, that's all that's going on.
it's we, Jim we
beg
dying.
We beg your forgiveness.
And they come and go. I have no control. And once they start, I can't stop it. So anyways, we will see how we do. Today's show is kind of a spur of the moment decision. I'd actually wanted Bob and Chris to kind of do a show today, but for scheduling issues, they couldn't. So I thought, well, I got to put something together. And we got an email in that I'm sure the sender never thought would become an EDU show, but it is about 2020-02, PTE 2020-02, which we'll explain to you in a minute. Anybody listening to this who has a retirement account, an IRA or a 401k or a 403b, technically speaking, maybe not 403bs. There's not enough guidance yet on that. But there are changes in the rules of moving your money. So we're going to be talking to you guys as non-industry professionals who are listening because you want to learn about retirement. There's going to be industry people, and every now and then I might say my point of view to the industry. I am by no means a compliance expert. A lot of this is coming from the people I have hired to give me the advice on what my firm needs to do to comply with this rule. But I want you, the majority of our listeners and are not financial professionals, you are do-it-yourselfers. I want you to understand why if you make a decision to move your money, it might be a hell of a lot harder than you think. And that's what this rule might do. So what is PTE 2020-02? That's government speak right there of a rule. Why do governments go out of their way to name rules just weird?
Well, it's the numbers make sense. It's the second rule in 2020. I'm almost positive that's what that means, that part.
Okay.
The PTE refers to the topic, prohibited Correct. Transaction exemption, but it's mm-hmm. all part of this big monolith that we call ERISA, right? The scary thing from 1974.
Right. So why don't we begin with the actual email question,
okay.
and then we'll go from there.
Sounds
so
good.
This came in on June 30th, so not too long ago. And it begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. I love listening to your show, and I can't wait for you to reopen." So we will sometime next year. I don't know when. "I just came across this article. And I piqued my interest as I hope to retire in the next year. And I have been wondering if it would be best for me to leave my 401k alone or roll it over. I would love to hear your thoughts on that and what you think of the article. Thanks." She leaves her real name, but in quotation marks, calls herself Georgette. I have no idea where Georgette lives, but the link to the article, folks, came from Apple News, but it was a Barron's reprint. So any of you like me who reads Barron's every week, you might have seen this. But it was just talking about the prohibited exemption transaction and how beginning July 1st, remember she sent this to me June 30th, how beginning July 1st, you're going to see some of the rules change if you go to move your money. Well, perhaps Chris is correct. It means 2020 is when the rule was proposed. Dash 02 means the second rule. I don't know. It makes sense. So maybe Chris is correct because the DOL proposed this rule several years ago. And what it essentially means, as Chris said, PTE stands for Prohibited Transaction Exemption. And under ERISA, and ERISA is the rule or the law, if you will, that protects 401ks and other retirement accounts. But TSP and 403b plans are not ERISA plans. Now, TSP, for you government employees, did adopt protection similar to ERISA. The government just passed laws that gave TSPs ERISA-like protections, even though a TSP is not subject to ERISA. 403Bs operate in their own world sometimes, and they're not always protected by any law. Well, I don't say any laws. They're protected more by state laws. In my opinion, this DOL rule will apply to both 403Bs and TSPs as well. And here's the kicker, folks. It's going to apply to your IRA. And Chris, technically speaking, does ERISA apply to IRAs?
No, it does not. IRAs are part of a set of accounts that are tax advantaged or get special tax treatment, but they are not ERISA qualified plans.
No, not
that's
at all.
The distinction.
Now, the law ERISA, when it was passed in the 1970s, actually created IRAs. But it didn't put IRAs under the same rules that employer-sponsored retirement plans have. The whole idea of ERISA when it first came out was to protect pension plans. It later got carried over to 401ks, which have replaced pension plans as employer-sponsored retirement accounts.
Yeah, it was essentially to protect the employees from in the past. Remember, this is 1974 that this came out. So the world of retirement and employer plans was very different prior to then. There's some legacy that we recognize, but the world was quite different. There were a lot of these plans that were kind of the wild, wild west, and employees found themselves victims, effectively, of unscrupulous business owners, or maybe businesses that just went south and the employees suffered in a way that they probably shouldn't. So they brought in all these protections to protect the employees from plans that favor maybe the owners and upper level management, or maybe protect from the businesses not running the retirement plan well or properly, and then it falls apart and employees were relying on it. So it was really a big issue, and this is a big piece of legislation that went on to address a lot of those things, and we still live with the legacy of this today from almost 50 years. We're coming up 2 years from now, the 50-year anniversary of ERISA.
Yeah. And back then, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and that's what ERISA was trying to protect, there were companies that robbed their retirement plans mm-hmm. in an effort to try to stay alive. And when the companies finally went under, there was nothing there. There was no pension, no nothing.
Right.
So ERISA had good intentions, and it still does. I don't mind ERISA at all. The only thing I'm pointing out is the DOL has tried several times to start regulating IRAs, and the industry is going after PTE 2020-02 as well, under the auspices that the DOL has not been specifically granted permission to regulate IRAs. I keep saying Congress could take care of this by just changing that. But I don't know if this rule is going to stay in effect, if any of these lawsuits are going to succeed in overturning it, like it succeeded in overturning what was that big DOL rule? What was it called again? Gosh, I can't even remember. Right before Trump got in, everybody blames him for getting rid of it, but it wasn't.
Yeah,
him.
It was
the DOL fiduciary rule.
DOL fiduciary rule.
Again, the court said the DOL doesn't have the power to regulate IRAs. But this applies to IRAs too. It applies if you move an IRA to an IRA. So keep that in mind. When you go to move money, you might start running into additional paperwork. So we just want to explain to you what the paperwork is and why it's being forced upon you by custodians or advisors. They are trying to follow a rule from the Department of Labor. PTE stands for Prohibited Transaction Exemption. That's what it's saying. That if the industry, let's call it the industry, the financial industry, wants to receive certain forms of payment for providing services, only certain forms are allowed. Now, under ERISA, it says Title I of ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code, and I'm reading I'm reading from a blog post that came out from one of the compliance firms that investment advisors such as my firm can utilize. They're saying the whole way that the DOL has the ability to pass these series of rules is that under ERISA, investment fiduciaries are prohibited from receiving compensation that varies based on their investment advice or compensation that is paid from third parties. So a third party form of compensation is a commission. That's another word for it. And compensation that varies based on their investment advice. That one's, to me, and I'm not an expert, a little confusing, and I don't quite get that, because this applies to AUM advisors, these quote-unquote fee-only advisors. It applies to registered reps of broker-dealers, who are the ones who generally receive commissions. But it also applies to advisors who are going to receive level AUM fees. They're also being pulled into this DOL prohibited transaction exemption. And what the DOL said is if a registered rep of a broker-dealer who's going to receive a commission or an investment advisor representative of a registered investment advisory firm who's going to charge an AUM fee, both of them are considered now prohibited transactions. You cannot do that, the DOL is saying. However, we understand your business model, so we're going to give you an exemption and allow you to charge a commission or allow you to charge your AUM fee if you follow a certain set of rules.
Right.
Hence the name prohibited transaction exemption.
Yeah. So the default is it's prohibited, but then if you qualify for the exemption, then you are free to do it.
Then you can still do it. So that's what the DOL is saying. And to claim the exemption, to say to the DOL, DOL is Department of Labor, in case you don't know, unknown to a lot of people out there, the Department of Labor regulates retirement plans, not the IRS. The IRS just enforces the penalties and the taxes associated with retirement plans. The DOL regulates them. In fact, from what I understand, and I could be wrong on this, and if you're a compliance expert, please correct me. The way the DOL is actually going to enforce that registered reps and broker dealers or investment advisor representatives and registered investment advisory firms are actually following this rule, the way they're going to enforce it is through the IRS. The IRS is going to impose some sort of fines because that's how the DOL enforces. The DOL doesn't have an investigative arm that's going to run around, start enforcing this. They're supposed to be doing it through the IRS. That's what I read. I wish I saved that article. I can't find it, but that's my best understanding of how they're going to do this. The actual enforcement is through the IRS. I could be wrong on that. That doesn't affect you listeners who are do-it-yourselfers. That's kind of a little throw out there. My understanding to anyone in the industry listening and anyone in the industry, if I'm getting it wrong, please write to me. I'm trying to figure this all out too. But anyways, to get the exemption, in order for an investment advisor to work with you, and you might be saying, listener, oh, I don't do an investment advisor. I'm going to do this all on my own. Well, if you move your money from, say, Fidelity to Vanguard or Vanguard to Schwab or something like that, you're going to run into this. You're going to run into the same problem. So that's why we're trying to teach this to you. Just want you to understand what you might be running into. So the DOL said to the industry, look, we understand this is the way you guys charge. You're either going to charge an AUM fee or you're going to charge a commission. Both of those, they say under ERISA, are prohibited transactions. But we, meaning the DOL, we're going to grant you an exemption if you follow four steps. You follow what is called an impartial conduct standard. You disclose certain items to your clients. That's number two. Number three, you or the firm you work for do an ongoing compliance requirement. You'll see what I mean in a second on that. And the firm, number four, will run a retrospective review of all prior rollovers every single year to make sure that they made sense then and they still make sense now. That's a big hurdle, number four, for the industry. You do-it-yourselfers, it's not, nothing you got to worry about. You're going to run into one, two, and three. Number four, you're not going to run into. But the industry, this retrospective review that has to be signed off by a compliance official of the firm all the time, that's a big hurdle. That's a lot of meat and potatoes in that one. Now, fortunately, in our industry, a lot of software is coming out that's going to help investment advisory firms, especially with number four. But it's oftentimes, Chris, regulators pass rules which make our job more difficult, which leads to higher what?
Fees.
Fees. And it's fees that the DOL was looking at. Mm-hmm. It was these reports that still come out all the time of all the fees that investment advisors are taking from retirement accounts that the DOL is going after. The downside to presenting these sets of rules, and I'll just talk as my firm, it's causing my firm more time, more effort, and more money. Time is money. Which means it may cause our fees to maybe have to rise. It's just the way it is. we have to follow these rules. And I like the rules. Believe it or not, I support what the DOL is trying to do. And if it comes off that I'm not, that's not my intent. I like what they're trying to do. I think the rule is a little hokey in places and a little bit difficult in other places, like this retrospective review requirement. That said, I support the DOL trying to get people to pay more attention to the fees they're paying. Now, you do it yourself as you're probably scratching your head saying, who doesn't pay attention to fees? I'd say 70% of the public. What do you think, Chris?
And that's why the industry's evolved into what it is. They've realized that they can extract. It's almost like I picture a leech on the side of your retirement account where they're sucking on it constantly, and they can leech a certain amount out of there without anybody really being bothered by it. It's just, you got one leech on you. Yes, it's going to be annoying, but it isn't horrendous. Tons of people just think that's the way it is, and they don't question it. And I think they get drained of more blood of their retirement accounts than need be in a lot of cases. In many, there's plenty of cases, though, where people are getting excellent value for what's being extracted from their accounts. So this certainly, but the unfortunately, the more common case, I think, is there isn't a great value proposition to what's being extracted. And ERISA, built to protect people with these accounts, this is a natural mechanism to have adjustments made to it to help stop that, or at least make people more aware so they can make informed decisions. Certainly, if you're fully informed and you still decide, yes, I want to have a bunch of leeches attached to me, that's your right, and go for it. Everybody should be able to make that decision with their own money. But I think it's underestimated by most people, and I think your 70% is probably low, the long-term effects of the draining of the account for these fees, and they don't realize how much their own retirement success is being undermined by this fee here, there, 12 different layers of fees, can't see them. Certain fees are justified and required. Other fees might very well be extra, and they don't need to be there. And over time, they're going to make a drastic, or at least a noticeable negative impact on your retirement. And is that fair? And DOL says, no, this should be addressed in some way. And this is their an ongoing attempts to do this, and this is the latest one. I think it's pretty significant what they're trying to do here.
Right, and I think this is going to change a lot over the coming years as they kind of work out the kinks. This is kind of the first run at it, if you will. But again, what the DOL was trying to do is at least bring to people's attention when you move money from an IRA to another IRA, or maybe from a 401k to an IRA, there's going to be fees associated with it. You're going to be giving up some fees and accepting other fees. And they just want that disclosed. That is their intent. So hopefully people can put two and two together and see what's in their best interest, to throw out that word again that's being used all the time. Now, the DOL says it is not a prohibited transaction to move from a low-cost 401k to a high-cost IRA. That's not a prohibited transaction. Or a low-cost IRA to a higher-cost IRA. Not a prohibited transaction. Fees alone are not the deciding factor. So this PTE exemption also has the advisor list, or the client prioritizes, a better way of putting it, what's important to them. What are you trying to do, Mr. and Mrs. Client? And then let's look and see, will the IRA provide that I'm recommending compared to the 401k you currently have? That's what so they accept that. It's not just fees. If it just came down to fees, most 401ks would never be moved. If this rule said, if the 401k has a lower fee, it cannot be moved to an IRA, most 401ks would never be moved.
Right.
Because a lot of 401k, well, most medium to large 401ks would never be moved. Most small 401ks would be moved in a heartbeat. Every small 401k, especially ones where the custodian is an insurance company, have just outrageously expensive mutual funds inside them, and you would be moving those in a heartbeat.
Yeah, and what's, just to clarify what Jim means there is not the size of your individual 401k, the size of the entire 401k plan itself.
Oh, small thank you. Plans. Yes, that's what
it has nothing directly to do with the size of your individual account. It's more the overall size and the efficiencies of scale that you get with the bigger plans overall. If you're coming from a big plan, even if you have a small balance yourself, a big plan almost always awards you or rewards you with a low fee structure. That's just, you know, the way it works out with scale. But you're right, smaller plans, not always the case. A lot of times they're noticeably higher fee than an external IRA, and there can be justification right there to move it.
Okay, so what does this all mean as for you? If you are working with an investment advisor, he or she is going to have to start doing this disclosure. Even if you are managing your own money and it's at a custodian, say Vanguard, and you want to move it to Schwab, Schwab may have you either complete a PTE 2020-02 exemption form, which is long. That's the great thing to understand. It's a lot of paperwork. Or have you sign a statement that Schwab did not instigate the movement of your money. You did on your own.
And that's because the tough, crazy tough one. That sounds clean, but aren't they marketing to people to try to get them to come to Schwab? Doesn't that right there violate that? That's the nuances of some of this that I'm going to find fascinating as they work through it.
Correct. Most companies do advertise on TV, you know, come to Schwab. We can help you with this. We offer that. So that's why I think those companies will have you walk through a complete PTE 2020-02 disclosure. Most of it is going to be computerized. We at our firm have subscribed to a computerized service. This all takes effect coming July 1st. So you might not have seen any of this prior to July. The online ones, they're, I find, Chris, juvenilistic. I'll give you an example, folks, and Chris, because Chris doesn't do what I do in the office and I don't do what he does. As I was evaluating one of these online services that people were supposed to go to, there's a whole section, folks, where you have to list what's important to you and why you want to move your accounts. And he was showing us the 401k module of, well, here's the questions that your clients are going to have to answer when moving their 401k. Not one of the reasons was to avoid RMDs on Roth 401ks. That wasn't even an option to choose.
That's a totally legitimate reason to do it.
No kidding. So I interrupted him and I said, I assume we're going to be able to edit this. And remove some of the silly ones you have and put in some of the more realistic ones, such as to avoid required minimum distributions on my Roth 401k. And he said, you can't edit this. He goes, what do you mean I can't edit this? Well, no, you can't edit this. And I had to explain to him, I said, do you realize Roth 401ks have required minimum distributions? And it's well within my client's best interest to get that Roth 401k moved before age 72, when they're going to have to start taking money out of an account that should be held for as long as possible, tax-free. He said, I'll take this up with the developers. It just, you got to be kidding me. You services out there who want me to use your service, have some better That's why I say it's all kind of been rushed in. Everybody thought this was going to be delayed or overturned. And when it wasn't, everyone's now trying to rush to get it set. Anyways, folks, what I'm getting at is you still may run into some of this where you're going to have to fill in the reasons why, even if you are the one who initiated, because as Chris said, a company like Schwab is always running advertisements. I think it would be wiser for them. I'm not a compliance person, but it would be wiser for a company like that to say, hey, we're going to have you do this anyways, because we do run some ads. Hey, you should move money over to us. But is that specific investment advice? I would say no, Chris. There is an exemption if the only advice you're giving is educational. So that is something to keep in mind. And a lot of investment advisors that I have spoken to are taking that approach. And they're saying, we don't recommend clients move any accounts. We provide education to help them evaluate their options. But the client is the one to make the choice. The DOL specifically says, if your advice was just educational that you gave to the client, it is not a prohibited transaction for them to decide on their own to move money to you. And you don't have to do all this. My compliance firm said, still have them sign a document, though, Jim, that says it was only educational advice, that the client, it's the client's money, it's the client's decision, they chose to move it. The DOL wanted to be certain, folks, that if you made a decision that you really do want to move to Vanguard or to Schwab or to TD, well, TD is going to become, is Schwab, to Fidelity or T. Rowe Price, all those companies you guys like, it's your money, and the DOL acknowledges that. If you truly made the decision, they don't want you to get tied up in all of this. Even if you're moving your money to a place that might charge you more than your 401k, although I admit Vanguard is pretty low cost, but maybe another custodian you choose has higher fees than what you have. They don't want you to be told, no, you can't do something with your own money. So they do say, if the receiving custodian only provided education to you and you made your decision on your own and it wasn't a recommendation from the custodian or advisor to move, then you don't have to worry about this. You're going to be allowed to move your money. I hope I explained that right, mm-hmm. but it's just something to keep in mind. And I know some investment advisors are saying we are no longer going to make any recommendation. I find that hard to believe because a lot of investment, most investment advisory firms live off of what, Chris? AUM.
Right. That's just the way the industry's evolved over many, 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 many decades. That's how they do it.
And a lot of firms, because we hear this all the time, I cannot hire XYZ firm to do a retirement plan unless I move my money to them. That's what it was. I went in, I met them, they told me they can give me a retirement plan and this, that, and the other thing, but I have to move my money to them. They don't offer the ability, like Chris and I do at our firm. You can manage your money any way you want. You don't have to bring us your money. We don't care. If you want us for our retirement planning service, we have a separate fee for that. That's fine. If someone wants to move money, though, that draws a fine line between recommendation and education. So, again, I don't want to turn this into a discussion with investment advisors, but keep that in mind, investment advisors. It's a fine line. My compliance consultant told me it's a very fine line, and he still recommends, and we will have clients sign something to that effect. If clients are moving money to us, we don't require it. It's our business model. It's right in our ADV. But if we have an financial planning client say, I want your help, we're just going to have them sign something. So you may see something like that with Charles Schwab or Vanguard even, folks, that, hey, it was your decision to move your money to Vanguard. Please sign here. They are doing this because of this prohibited transaction rule. But if you are working with an investment advisor who truly does make the recommendation, you should take your money from that 401k and move it to me. Now that investment advisor has to explain why that is in your best interest. And they do it in what is called the impartial conduct standard. And what that essentially means is that the investment advisor has to be certain. It's in the client's, quote unquote, best interest. We keep hearing that all the time. To move that the advisor is acting as a fiduciary. And this is a big one, Chris, with registered reps of broker dealers who are not duly registered as investment advisors. They're held to a suitability standard, not a fiduciary standard. But under this, they have to disclose that they are going to act as a fiduciary. That's my understanding. I could be wrong, but it's pretty straightforward when I read it that someone who is technically just a suitability standard, not a fiduciary, has to be giving fiduciary advice when it comes to moving those accounts. I know you haven't been reading this law like I have, mm-hmm. but have you heard anything to the contrary?
No, I haven't. But I haven't. Like I said, I've been. This has been kicked around so much over the last couple of years that when it first came out, or these a lot of these proposals, I was looking at it pretty closely, but then I learned half the stuff I read turned out not to be true, and then it got paused and all this kind of stuff. So I've honestly not been that focused on it until it actually started to be implemented. So now that we're there, I'm glad we're doing this show because we're on the cusp of some of these things. But a lot of this is going to have to be worked out. It's not how they interpret and apply some of this stuff is still not totally clear.
Well, I haven't heard anything that if you are a registered rep, you still don't have to be a fiduciary. Under this rule, you have to be acting as a fiduciary and what's best for your client. Because number two under the impartial conduct standard is all communications that you make to the client cannot be misleading. An attorney could fly a 747 through that verbiage. It can't be misleading. There is such a big hole there. They don't define what misleading is or anything like that. They just say it can't be misleading. I would hope investment advisors aren't being misleading with people. I know there's a lot of people out there, though, in our industry who are misleading. My point is this, and Chris and I have said it repeatedly, you can't legislate morality. If someone was going to be misleading before 2020-02 came around, they're going to be misleading after 2020-02. But anyways, the advice you receive is not supposed to be misleading. And then the one that makes me smile the most, because the DOL doesn't define it, but it is part of the impartial conduct standard that now must be followed. And this is going to apply, listeners, more if you are going to hire someone to help you with managing your money as opposed to being a do-it-yourselfer who's just trying to change from one custodian to another. But under the impartial conduct standard, Chris, all forms of compensation must be reasonable. Can you tell me what reasonable is?
There's that word again.
Because in my opinion, the vast majority of investment advisors are charging unreasonable fees, but that's just my opinion, starting with Ken Fisher and moving on down. What's reasonable?
I know. It's probably going to be reasonable and ordinary kind of a thing. And since the ordinary charges are somewhat excessive in the industry, they can point to that and say, no, this is normal. This is ordinary. So
it's reasonable.
Yeah, so it's reasonable. So I'm not sure that's going to protect a lot of people, even though the word reasonable is extremely subjective. I hate when they use that. I really hate when they use that. Because who's to argue what's reasonable or not?
And then what they have to do is help you walk through all this, listeners. So if you're going to be working with an actual investment advisor, I think it's going to get a lot more work. Again, you do it yourselfers, just moving yourself from one custodian to another. I have a feeling they're going to have you sign something that says you made this decision, not them. So I think it'll be pretty straightforward. But if you are going to work with an investment advisor, you're now going to see this thing get gummed up, because now the investment advisor has to, first of all, disclose to you they are acting as a fiduciary. I think that is why I say registered reps are being pulled into this as well, Chris, because registered representatives who are not duly licensed as investment advisor representatives do not operate as fiduciaries. They don't. They operate under a suitability standard. A registered rep is the old broker, the old stockbroker they used to call themselves, the commission-based stockbrokers and things of that nature. There's still a lot of them out there, and they have to disclose that they are acting as a fiduciary. Well, an investment advisor representative of a registered investment advisory firm, as we've been teaching you, is under the fiduciary standard, not the suitability standard. They have to act as a fiduciary. It's already going to be in their ADV and disclosed to you. But they are also going to have to highlight it separately and tell you they're acting as a fiduciary. That's why I think they put this in there, because they're pulling the registered reps who are not fiduciaries under this kind of fiduciary umbrella. And that makes it, I guess, easier to hold them accountable if you in the future feel the decision or the product they put you in was not in your best interest. Because now they're a fiduciary, not a suitability standard. That's my take, but I am not a compliance expert or an attorney. But that was my take on it. So they now you're going to have to be given a disclosure that they're acting as a fiduciary, and they have to start walking you through what is important to you. Here is why I feel you should move your money. You have told me you're looking, and I'm just going to throw some reasons out there. You were looking to consolidate your holdings. You were looking for a broader array of investments. You don't like the company you used to work for, and you want to sever all ties with them. Give me some other reasons why people might move money there, Chris. Beneficiary designations. Yeah. You want a custodian that will allow a trust as beneficiary or something like that. A lot of 401ks don't allow that. Yep. So there can be any number of reasons why you want to move this account.
Here's another one that people don't think of is the restrictions on access.
True. So we have seen 401ks.
How often you can ask for money and that sort of thing.
Especially small 401ks. As Chris said, not your account, but the overall business account is just a small business. We have seen 401ks like that limited people to one distribution a quarter, and there was one that also charged $40 per distribution, right, including an RMD.
Yeah.
Obviously, that 401k didn't want you to stay there, and they were going out of their way to get you the hell out of there.
Yep.
So there could be any number of reasons why you want to move the account. And now the advisor and you have to walk through those reasons. Why is it not so much why you want to move it, but why are they recommending you move it? Well, Mr. and Mrs. Client, you told me you wanted to do this, this, and this, and the 401k doesn't allow that. So that's how the service that we subscribe to is going to walk people through something like that. You indicated these 4, 5, 6 things, I forget how many there was, are important to you. The 401k, here is their ability to provide that service. And the IRA you're being recommended, here it is. And they score it on a number. Then they add up all the numbers. And the one with the highest number total is the best account to keep it in. That's how they do it. It's kind of straightforward, Chris. Mm-hmm. So it can add it all up. And it might be that the software says you should keep the money right where it is in the 401k and not move it. Now, at that point, can you be prevented from moving it? No, it's your money. It's your decision. You do as you please. But the investment advisor is going to make you sign a disclosure stating that. that in his or her opinion, you should be leaving the money in the 401k based on the reasons you gave them, and you shouldn't move it. But anyways, that's kind of how this is going to be done. At least this is how some people are doing it. I know at my firm, I'm going to go to my own design form and website for doing this. I don't like the subscription ones, but they're up and running, so I'm going to use them. But in my firm, we're going to do it on our own separately in the future. But what the DOL is trying to do here, Chris, is really help the people to say, hey, if this guy or gal is telling you to move the account to them, make them lay out why they made that recommendation. I support that. Do you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, because it's a conversation that hasn't been had enough in the past. And again, people will generally watch out for themselves when they have the information that equips them to watch out for themselves. And if they have to, it has to be disclosed that the fees are going to be higher, or that there's this, that, and the other thing, or that they're using a bogus reason to recommend the switch or something like that, then you can't pull the whole wool over their eyes nearly as easily, which unfortunately has been happening a lot in the business.
Exactly. So I support what the DOL is doing, and any competent investment advisor is not going to mind this part. It's a lot of paperwork. It's going to gum up the process of moving these accounts, which is already slow at times as it is. It's just going to be another step and another cog. But there is one part of this effort, if you will, from the DOL that is going to be real difficult for people and advisors to satisfy. And that's the next part. Once you've documented why you think the money should move, that's that whole second step. First step, disclose to you they're acting as a fiduciary right up front. No ifs, ands, and buts about it. Second step, why are they making the recommendation? Remember, if you came in with the thought, I want to move to you, no problem, sign this, that it was your idea. But if the investment advisor made the recommendation, move your money to me, second step, they have got to now explain why. And that's how most are going to do it. They're going to just compare the two accounts and say, this is why, and here's all the things you're going to be able to do in the IRA that you can't do in the 401k. It's just to help you get some ideas to make sure it makes sense. But step three, folks, is going to be really hard. The fees of the 401k. It sounds easy. It's really hard to figure out what in the heck you're paying in your 401k. It truly is. Now, longtime listeners know I serve on the retirement board of a Northern Colorado employer. I've never named who it is, and I never will. But that 401k adopted not too long ago, I think it was about 5 years ago now, and I voted for it, to go from this very opaque revenue sharing, which I'll have Chris explain in a minute what it means, revenue sharing way of paying for the 401k's fees, to using investments that don't share any revenue and instead charge a flat fee. This is a very big plan, hundreds of millions of dollars, thousands of employees, and the cost, Chris, is $75 a year. It's not that expensive. So it's only $75 a year plus the fees of the investments. And the investments run the gamut from very low cost index mutual funds to very high cost actively managed mutual funds. That's going to get a little bit difficult, because the DOL says when evaluating fees, you can't look at just what the person is in. You got to look at the whole plan. So now an investment advisor has got to get all the information from you. Okay, how many? I've seen 401ks with 200 investments in them, and I've seen others with 10. You got to evaluate the fees of 200 investments and figure out what the average investment fee is. I think this is getting a little crazy. So the DOL says that the investment advisor has to make a good faith effort to get this. Well, where the hell do you think I'm going to get this? I'm going to go to the client and say, can you please get all this information from your employer? I have a feeling employers are going to get so fed up with this and the third-party administrators who run the 401ks for them that eventually this information will be available online in a moment's notice. It's just that right now,
initially, they're not geared to do it. Yeah.
They're not geared for this. What do you call it? When you make a good faith effort and that doesn't work, so you go to a safe harbor for the investment advisor and for you wanting to move your money, because you might be faced with this even if you want to do it. A good safe harbor is if you got industry averages for the size plan. So now the investment advisor just has to somehow figure out, and you can get it from some of the filings and some of these subscription services like I belong to has a lot of this in there already. Try to get what the average plan of that size charges and what the average fee on the investments is. Mm-hmm. That's a safe harbor. Why is the DOL forcing all this? Because you have to, as the investment advisor, if they are making the recommendation, they have to say, this is what you're paying and this is what I'm going to charge. I did say you were going to explain what revenue sharing is. Why don't you explain that?
Well, it's when the underlying investments like the mutual funds, the other investment options that are within the plan, charge fees of their own within their system, and then some of those fees they collect, they actually kick back, and that's a naughty word in the industry, but that's the most effective way to describe it to people.
They call it sharing.
Right? They share back money that they collected in their own fee structure with the plan itself to offset the costs of the plan, and a lot of plan providers were fascinated by this because they're thinking, you know, this is a cost to us as a company to implement and manage this plan. You mean we can get these shared revenues, what I call the kickback, that will offset the costs for us? That sounds attractive. Well, it's just a shifting of the burden, essentially, or you're paying it anyway, but makes it very, what's the opposite of transparent? Opaque. In the fees that you're ultimately paying as the participant of the plan. You're like, oh, my plan is super low cost. They only, they don't charge me any annual fee, or they charge me $10 a year or something like that. But you don't realize that the investment choices that you're in are charging fees that you don't really have visibility of easily. And that's actually what's funding it. And you turn out to be paying higher fees than you expected. So it's revenue sharing, where the underlying investment choices are collecting fees of their own and then sharing them back with the plan to offset costs.
And here's the dirty little secret of the industry and why this employer changed. So most employers have smartened up through lawsuits.
Yeah.
And
glad you
no
said it that
long,
way.
Yeah. Right. Not on their own.
Right.
Through lawsuits that they've lost, and started replacing revenue sharing with a flat fee pricing. Mm-hmm. But most small 401ks still do it by revenue sharing, mostly because the cost would be very high and people would not like seeing it. So they do it with revenue sharing. So you're still going to find a lot of very expensive revenue sharing mutual funds in a 401k. But you are going to find more and more 401ks that charge the flat fee. However, here's what makes it difficult. Let's go back to the employer that I have volunteered on their retirement board for. Here's some of the issues that we ran into and why we adopted flat fee pricing. I won't say who on the retirement board, but someone very smart picked up on that some people weren't paying anything to have the 401k. Mm-hmm. And other people were picking up their costs.
Right. Because of the inconsistency in the revenue sharing.
Of the revenue sharing. Mm-hmm. And people who have been on the longest and showed the most dedication to the employer were being forced to pay a boatload of money through revenue sharing. And a new person who hasn't proven themselves to the firm at all, we're paying hardly nothing for their account. Mm-hmm. And it's all because the larger the account, listeners, mm-hmm. the more they're paying. The smaller the account, the less they pay. Why? Because there's not as much invested. But this retirement account also started bringing on board a lot of lower priced indexed holdings. Again, someone else who volunteered on the board who was very smart pointed out that should be offered. There should be more index options offered. So now you had a situation where there were low cost, no revenue share. You put a Vanguard fund in a 401k, Vanguard never revenue shares. You put a low cost Vanguard index holding in a 401k and then people put money into it. They're not paying anything. And people who still have a more actively managed or higher cost mutual fund, they're paying. So a lot of us on the retirement board thought this is no longer good. And we should go to a flat fee pricing. However, you still have to look at the investment costs. $75, there's no IRA being managed by an investment advisor that's not going to charge you at least $75. So a $75 fee is very low. However, depending on what that person is invested in, they could be paying a lot more in investment fees. And that's where this gets difficult, trying to show people exactly what you're paying. It can be done with software, and it can be done by having you go to your employer and asking for this. And mark my words, a year from now, 2 years or less, all of this is going to be readily available because the TPAs and the employers and the HR departments are going to be fed up with people asking for it. But for now, that's what we have to do. Where I think the DOL dropped the ball, they don't want it disclosed in dollars. You can just disclose it in percentages. I hate that. 1%, that doesn't sound like much, does it, Chris?
Right. It sounds so harmless.
Oh, it's so tiny. It's teeny tiny. It's still not presented in dollars. In the DOL fiduciary rule that got killed in, 2017, 2018 now? I forget how long ago. They wanted it disclosed in dollars and over a 10-year period. You would have to be disclosed what you are going to pay if you move this money to the AUM guy. This is why the AUM industry hated this rule. If you moved it to an AUM guy, this is what they're going to charge you. And if your account grew at such and such a rate and we kept our fees, this is what you're going to pay us in 10 years, in dollars. That, I think, would have been much better to accomplish what the DOL is trying to do. The DOL is trying to get people to understand how much money are you losing and what are you getting for that money. That's what they're trying to show you. So that's why they're having the whole step of you should move it because we're going to give you this, this, and this, and you told us that was important, and only this and this, but not this, is often in the 401k. So we can give you all three. Again, I'm just making this example up. And that's why we think you should move it. And oh, we're going to charge you 1%. And oh, your 401k is charging $75. And the average fee expense is 50 basis points. Well, that doesn't sound too bad. Okay, I'll move it. But I think it should be disclosed in dollars because percent sounds so small, 1%. You never hear the AUM guys saying, you never see an ad with Ken Fisher right on TV. You never see it with him. It's always his employees now. And the old, we do better when you do better. I hate that. Our pay is structured that when we do better, when you do better, we do better. Do it in dollars, Ken. Our pay is structured that as your account goes from $1 million to $2 million, our pay goes from $10,000 to $20,000. You don't hear him saying it that way. I disagree with the DOL here. I think they should have forced dollars. That's my personal thought. What is yours, Chris? Because I know you
don't
follow
this. And I think
this.
They could easily do both of them in a fully, I think a fully transparent advisor who's walking them through this might even do the translation for them. They shouldn't be embarrassed to do it. If you're embarrassed about what
you're
charging.
Embarrassed by your fee, you're charging too much.
Exactly. You should be able to stand there and totally justify the fee.
One of the things that we talked about recently, there's a lot we hate about our industry, if you haven't figured this out by now, but one of the things we hate is the opaqueness, if you will, of the AUM fee. What the hell are you getting for it? Itemize it. Maybe you'll start seeing this now. That, hey,
well,
I'm recommending.
It helps satisfy the rule, right? To show people what they're getting. And
well, people might ask. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe it'll force them to say, hey, yes, your 401k is charging 75. Again, I'm just using the one that I know, 75 bucks. Your 401k is charging $75 and your average management fee is 0.5. And the ETFs that you're in or the index mutual funds you're in inside are only charging 0.1. And I want to move you to this 1% fee, but here's why. And then maybe they will lay it all out that, look, I'm going to give you a tax plan. I'm going to give you a retirement plan, a financial plan. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do the other thing. I don't know. Maybe it'll finally force them to start defending their fee if they charged or had to disclose dollars. That's what I'm getting at. If the DOL would force dollars to be told and not just, we're going to charge you 0.8% or 1% or 1.25%. That just sounds so harmless. And believe it or not, you do it yourselfers, because we see this in our practice. There are people who start working with us, and when we ask, what are you paying your current advisor? What's one of the more common answers we hear, Chris?
Not quite sure.
Yeah, I don't know. And it amazes us, but they truly don't know. They have no idea what they're paying and why. I think if the DOL was to say in dollars, disclose as best you can what they're paying in the 401k and what they're going to pay in the IRA you recommended they move to, that will force, if it comes to, let's say you're going to move a $2 million IRA and it's going to be quote unquote 1%. That's 20 grand a year. That's an elk hunting trip and a fishing trip twice over for me every year. That's a hell of a lot of money, 20 grand a year. Maybe it'll force them to say, well, we're going to charge you 20,000, but here's what we're getting. We're going to break it all out for you. We're going to itemize how that 20,000 came up. That's a big thorn in our side, or a burr in our hiney, or whatever that saying is. I can't think straight out of COVID.
That sounds pretty good.
But was I close at least?
Yeah.
All right. We can't stand how nothing is disclosed on this all pure, altruistic 1% AUM fee or whatever the fee of the RIA is. I just think the DOL should force it in dollars. If people knew, oh, I'm only paying my advisor 1%, or I'm paying my advisor $20,000 a year, which one's going to get your attention more? Seriously, Chris.
Yeah, I agree.
So anyways, that's it, folks. That's what the DOL is trying to do, just kind of get you to understand there is a cost for moving. You want to make sure it's truly in your best interest. And how are they going to do that? They're going to force the advisor to say they are a fiduciary. They're going to force them, again, if the advisor is making the recommendation, if you make it, none of this applies. If you it's a new advisor, you don't know, and they're saying, hey, I think you should move your money to me, they have to explain why. Why is this in your best interest? They're going to do it with a checklist. They're going to do it like the software we use, the sliding little scale that rates things by numbers. They're just going to come up with reasons why they're making the recommendation, and they should have it. There's got to be a reason, so they should be able to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're going to have to compare the fees. But as percentages, folks, not dollars. That's where I think the DOL dropped the ball on this. If they were trying to get people to take this seriously and understand, the thing is, I once, and I told you this statistic, and I have no idea if it is true, but it was said to me. Y'all know I used to work for, I say it now, Waddell & Reed, when I first got into this industry 25 years ago now. Waddell & Reed doesn't exist anymore as it used to, so I'll mention their name now. But I remember going to what was supposed to be an educational thing that just turned into a sales pitch down in Denver. I drove down from Fort Collins. Someone stood up on stage, Chris, and said, 15% of the population is never going to take their investing in retirement serious. You don't want to market to them. 15% of the population are do-it-yourselfers who will never pay you to manage their money. You don't want to work with them. But 70% of the population, that's who you're going for because they will pay. That's how he worded it. So that's how I came up with 70% of the population. I don't know if it's 70, 80, 90, but I'm telling you, a wide swath of the population, not you people listening to this podcast, no one's going to pull the wool over your eyes, but most people out there don't take this seriously and won't do the math. If the AUM guy is going to charge 0.8%, but offer this, that, and the other thing, and the 401k is charging 0.6%, you're going to think, oh, that's nothing. I'm going to move it. It's a little bit more or a little bit less, whatever. But if they had to put it into dollars and tell you, yeah, we're going to charge you $20,000 a year and the 401k is charging you $2,000 a year. Now they have to explain why. Well, we're going to do this, 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 and this. And maybe it'll force them to add some clarity to that 1% AUM fee. I don't know. I wish they would do that, but I think the industry is still too powerful. If they ever approached it that way, this thing wouldn't have seen the light of day. Anyways.
Yeah, I think the goal, I believe, is to make things more transparent so people know. People will tend to watch out for themselves as long as they're equipped with the information to make that determination. And it's been too hard for them to understand their situations under the current system. So I think this is a step in the right direction. Hopefully it won't be too cumbersome that causes, you know, legitimate things to maybe not happen or not happen as easily as they could. But as long as it's reasonable in the implementation and processes, I think this is a step in the right direction. And I agree, dollars staring you in the face are more impactful than the little 0.6%, 0.8%. Those conversations seem to minimize what's going on there, but I'm a net impressed, I guess, that this is finally coming to an investment product near you. that it's, you know, we've heard this talked about for a long time, and at least this is one step. Many steps to go. It's not
going to apply to brokerage accounts, so don't worry about that. Yeah. What we call maybe taxable brokerage accounts, they are not regulated by the DOL. Personally, folks, the DOL doesn't regulate IRAs either, but they're applying it to IRAs. They only regulate ERISA-protected plans. 403Bs and TSPs are not ERISA-protected plans, but it applies to them too. I don't know if this rule will survive court challenges. I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. It could take a couple of years. I think Congress needs to get involved, and I think Congress needs to take this seriously.
And they seem to be really active right now doing things regarding people's retirement. So it's clearly a topic that is top of mind in Congress. So
the problem is the politicians are in the hook, in the pocket of the insurance industry, the investment industry, you know that. Yeah. So there's no big push. Congress could clean this up in a heartbeat if they wanted to and mandate fees be disclosed in dollars. We do. We have a capped fee structure on our asset management. We may bill it as a percentage of assets, but we cap our fee in dollars, and we always talk dollars to our clients. If we're going to manage your money, it's going to cost you $4,000 a year, $5,000 a year, $6,000 a year, whatever the case is. Cap fee structure, pretty much runs from 3,500 to 6,000, irrespective of the size of your account. We disclose it in dollars to people. Mm-hmm. It's right there in dollars. This is what you're going to pay us. And it's like Chris says, if you can't say in dollars to a person what you're going to charge them, maybe you shouldn't be charging them that. If you can't defend it, if you're embarrassed by it, if you're hiding under your desk because you're taking 15 grand out of someone's assets, I don't want to say just retirement assets, mm-hmm. but assets in total, you're taking 15 grand out, but you know deep down you're barely giving them $2,000 a year of service because they're in some model and you're not even monitoring it. It's being managed by a third party or something. Those are the people who are going to struggle. But Chris and I have no problem telling people we charge to manage their portfolio. And it's the one reason why we always charge separately for financial planning. We don't mm-hmm. roll it into assets and tell people, oh, we're going to charge you 1%, but we're going to do a plan for you too. You're getting everything. No, we itemize everything right out there for people to see. That's where I wish the industry would go. I don't know. If you're a young advisor, start doing that. Don't hide behind the AUM. I know there's a lot of people listening to this. You've been doing it for 20 years. You only got another 5 to go before you retire. All right, I'll give you guys a free pass. But if you're new, don't get sucked into the AUM model. Just disclose to your clients in dollars what they're going to pay. I adopted that. What's it been now? 5 years ago, Chris? I forget.
Maybe longer.
I honestly can't remember because I was under the AUM model. I started as a broker under the commission model at Waddell & Reed. I hated it. And I got out of there in less than 2 years and I went to the AUM model. But I told you listeners long ago, I hated that too. I didn't feel it made any sense. There were some people I was getting way more money out of them than I felt I gave in services. And there were other people that were getting way more in services out of me than I was actually getting in fees. And I thought, this is nuts. I'm just going to charge fees for people. And they can decide if our fees are reasonable or not. And Chris and I love it. We have nothing to hide. This is what we're going to charge, and that's it. But if you're working with an AUM person, who knows what you're paying and why? That's the thing. Why? They don't itemize it. Why am I paying you 8, 10, 12, 15,000 a year? What am I getting for it? I think that's where the DOL, though, dropped the ball. Anyways, that gives you an idea of what the DOL is trying to do. I support what they're trying to do. Give the industry time, folks, to please get this to work smoothly. It's not. It's a big kink. Eventually, the whole industry, this will be second nature and it won't be a big deal. But it might slow down some things and it might slow down you guys as you're trying to move accounts on your own. You're being told, oh, wait a minute. No. You got to do this first. So keep that in mind.
Nice. Okay. Well, we'll keep you apprised of any developments regarding this or any side effects we start to see in the industry, just so you can be informed and be prepared for these types of questions and events that come up. Mention everybody, we do appreciate how much you stick with us, listen to the shows every single week. We've got a Q&A show coming up later this week. Hope you stay tuned for that. And if you've got a recommendation for either an EDU show or a Q&A question, feel free to email us. Probably best to just email Jim, jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. And we can't guarantee that you'll get your question answered, but We are on the lookout for good questions always. What makes the show work? So we would appreciate your participation in that relationship. So Jim, you get better. Hopefully by Friday and 3 more days when we record the next show, you'll be on the mend, if you will.
I hope
and
I'm negative.
If not, I'll
by
call
then.
Bob in and we'll do something with Bob.
Well, I hope I'm negative by then. Do you have any idea how long it takes me to get negative?
That varies. Like I think I told
See,
you before.
See, the reason is I've been looking forward all year to this Led Zeppelin cover band that's coming to Colorado.
When?
And I wanted to go see it Friday night.
Oh, and that one's going to be tough.
I grew up with Led Zeppelin. And granted, it's a cover band, but I thought, oh, perfect. And Rachel, who has no idea who Led Zeppelin even was going to come with me. And I just don't know if I'll be negative by Friday. Anyways, it's really going to stink. I guess I could go wearing an N95 mask and everyone will just look at me like, what the hell is this guy doing? But anyways, that's this Friday. Hopefully I'll be able to make it. But stay safe out there, people. And
is it an outdoor concert?
Yeah, it's an outdoor concert.
Oh.
I guess I could stay like in the back away from people, right?
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I think they don't want you around other people.
Well, I won't. I'll just be antisocial.
Oh, just normal behavior?
No, I can be social at times.
I know. We saw you all partying at that show with the fancy
jacket. That's right, with a blonde on each side of me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was...
Hey, you got to give me credit. I went for a week to Florida.
That was extra social.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I went for a week to Florida with my girlfriend and came back, and she's still my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. And you were social enough to contract COVID. So there you go.
Somehow contracted COVID, yes. Yeah. So we'll have to watch that.
Okay.
Well, all righty. I'll talk to you guys later.
Okay.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.